You are Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush says marriage should be between a man and a woman. So does the Vatican. But the fact is, legalization of same-sex marriage is on tap in the courts in states from New Jersey and Massachusetts to Arizona and the legislature in California. Canada leapfrogged the U.S., but maybe not for long. In June, the Supreme Court defended gay sex, and the hottest new show on television is Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. America is heading into new territory. We've heard from policymakers and politicians. Tonight, we turn to the children of gay parents to hear their thoughts on the experience of growing up with gay parents in America. It is more common every year, but not always easy. Tonight on Point, I've got two moms. My dad is gay. We hear from the kids of a new era. If gay marriage becomes the law of the land, will the kids be all right? Will it work in your school, your neighborhood, your town? Does it work already? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by a gang from right across the country who've had an experience increasingly common, though not well known to many Americans even now. Joining us tonight from Madison, Wisconsin is Sol. She's 16, a junior in high school. Two moms. Good evening and welcome in Madison, Sol.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
I am so happy to be here.
It's great to have you. From Baltimore, Maryland, we're joined by Samantha. She's a second-year master's student in health science at Johns Hopkins University, 24 years old now. Parents divorced. Turned out she had a gay father. He was awarded custody when she was 8. Samantha, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And joining me in the studio tonight is Nathaniel. He's 15, lives in southeastern Massachusetts. Two moms, Nathaniel, if I've got that right. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
So each of you has had an experience that that is still kind of new territory to an awful lot of Americans, but becoming more common all the time. We're really grateful to you for joining us tonight. We really want to understand what this is like. There's a lot of talk now about legalizing gay marriage, and even without that happening, there are families of all kinds being created in this country. We're hoping to get some insights into how it really works and how it's worked for you. Sol, if I can turn to you first, tell us a little bit about your experience. How did you come to have two moms, and how's it worked for you?
Well, my parents have been together for 25 years, and so I was born into a family with two absolutely wonderful lesbian moms. My parents had always been involved in social justice work their whole lives, and made sure that we grew up in a multicultural neighborhood, a neighborhood with lots of all different kinds of diversity, and also made sure that I always had role models of all different kinds of people. And so from the time I was a little kid, I grew up in gay culture, and I grew up knowing that I had a family who loved me and loved each other very, very much.
And now you're 16. How has it been? It sounds like under the roof of the house, inside the home, it's been terrific for you. How's it been out in the world? How do your peers, your classmates, how have they accepted your kind of groundbreaking arrangements at home?
Well, I think it is hard once you start school. I think everyone has a different experience in gay families. I know from a young age, my parents were always very active in trying to make the schools a safer place for gay families and for gay and lesbian students. But it is hard. I remember when we're filling out the forms for kindergarten, they crossed out one of my mother's names and saying that she wasn't a parent. And then in my second week of kindergarten, a kid actually beat up another kid while calling him a fag.
A kindergartner?
A kindergartner.
Wow.
So for my first experience of school, I did feel that prejudice, and I did feel that oppressive nature. And also, I think, in the laws of our land, I know what it's like to grow up in a family where I'm denied a legal parent-child relationship with one of my moms, where, you know, I could get taken away from her, or where my family doesn't have Social Security benefits. And so I think from the time I was in school, I always was taught that, you know, our Constitution says that all people are created equal. But then when you see the injustice in our own system, that my family can't have those same rights as other families.
And it always has been rough for Americans who are kind of out on the leading edge. I understand middle school was particularly tough for you, Sol.
Middle school was really hard for me.
What happened?
Well, I went through a lot of harassment. I'm the kind of kid, I stand up about all different kinds of oppression. I remember standing up about sexism and racism and homophobic comments. And I really did get targeted, and it was hard and it was painful. But I remember holding my head up high and you know, really trying to educate, because I felt like the homophobia really came out of not understanding and was just reinforced by, you know, anti-same-sex marriage bills and just the greater societal prejudice.
So we can hear the bravery in your voice and hear you standing tall, but I want people to understand exactly how tough it could be sometimes. You were thrown down the stairs in middle school.
Yes, I was tripped down the stairs while being called gaywad and faggot. Yeah, it is. It can be incredibly painful and incredibly hard, and it's such a sad thing to go through. And I remember my parents always made sure that I knew that they'd be proud of me no matter what, mm-hmm. and that if I chose that I'd feel safer not to be out about my family, that would be okay. And they also gave me the tools, I think, from a young age to deal with some of the homophobia. They, you know, they did role plays with me as a young kid, so I knew how to face that.
Here's how to handle this. Here's
exactly,
how to handle that.
Exactly. So I didn't go into it alone in that way. And I always had a supportive family, I could talk about things with. And I think that's one of the things I'm really lucky about, is I had parents who, you know, loved me unconditionally in that way, but also gave me the skills to face the oppression. And I think when you're a part of a minority group, like you are growing up in a gay family, just like in African-American culture, you know, you need those skills.
So stand by. I want to turn to Samantha in Baltimore. Samantha, you're a bit older. You've got some perspective on this. I mean, the whole phenomenon is fairly recent, fairly new, at least in the kind of numbers that we're seeing now. And there's anywhere, the numbers are all over, anywhere from 250,000 families to 1 million families to many more, where there are two gay parents, sometimes one gay parent with custody, as in your case. A few years ago, you're 24 now, but a few years ago you wrote that in an essay, you said, "The truth is that I've been so tired of the queer community, ready to embrace my identity, that I've not been all that active or interested in the queer stuff, not interested in seeing another movie about queer people." How old were you then? What was on your mind? And how do you see the experience now with the vantage of a 24-year-old, Samantha?
I wrote that when I was about 20 on a college website. Mm-hmm. And I guess it is interesting to see right now this whole cultural phenomenon of starting to talk about queer issues or gay and lesbian issues. Mm-hmm. And sort of bringing it into the mainstream. But I think what was really difficult for me was that it wasn't mainstream. And it's been about, in the last 10 years, I would say, this has become, starting with Ellen DeGeneres coming out, which mm-hmm. happened when I was in college mm-hmm. on national TV, mm-hmm. It suddenly became something that was discussed. But up until that point, and definitely in the 80s when my parents' custody battle was going on, there was a lot of homophobia and there wasn't really a venue or an arena for discussion. So now it's sort of strange to me to see this whole culture. First of all, kids like Soul growing up mm-hmm. with gay parents from the very beginning, where their family was created from that mm-hmm. starting point, as opposed to families that are created out of dissolution and divorce, which I think raises a whole other set of issues. So not only do you have to deal with divorce, but you also have to deal with this new identity of your family.
So you had to come into it through a little more of a baptism by fire, and when it wasn't quite as easy, not that it's always easy now, as we heard from Soul, can you tell us the basics of the story? Your father realized or came out as gay when you were, what, 6, 7, 8 years old?
No,
there was a custody battle?
Actually, I was much younger. My father was always, had identified with interest in men as well as women, and he was mm-hmm. truly in love with my mother, and they chose to get married, and she was aware that he had had some homosexual experiences. They had been together for about 4 years, and they got married, and then they had me, and mm-hmm. they divorced when I was 2.
Okay.
And so I was very young, and this has actually been something that I've pretty much lived with my whole life. My father got a partner very shortly after my parents' divorce or separation, actually. And then sort of for the next 12 years, my parents' custody battle
went
sort
on
of
and
ebbed
on
and flowed.
And mm-hmm.
Yeah, it went on for a very long time. And when I was about 7, initially my parents had joint custody, but my father, I wasn't allowed to be around any known homosexuals. That's the language in the court case.
The custody decision, let your father have custody, but you couldn't be around homosexuals?
Right. Well, I mean, I think, I don't remember the exact words, or I don't think I've mm-hmm. read it directly, but I wasn't allowed to be around any other known homosexuals. So his partner wasn't allowed to be in the house when I was there. And I don't remember the exact trajectory of the case, but when I was 7, my mother violated custody agreement and my father was given awarded custody. And then I was still allowed visitation with my mother.
So it was rough sometimes. The custody battle was bitter. The relationships between your parents was not good. But from the vantage of a 24-year-old, what's your sense? This wasn't always easy. You've got a divorce plus the gay element here. But did it work for you? Looking back, Are you saying, hey, lots of families get divorced. This is how it happened in my family and it was all right? Or, I was overwhelmed by the sort of the weight of having to carry this social issue, this gay issue.
I don't feel that I was overwhelmed by the weight of the social issue. I mean, I definitely had this sort of distinct feeling that my family, I was loved in my family. I was cared for. I was given a lot of opportunities and privileges. And that came out of my father being a good parent. His sexuality was not so much the issue. And I think that's something that gets overlooked a lot in this discussion of gay parents is, especially with the gendered roles, oh, this person doesn't have have a mom and a dad, or this person only has, you know, two mothers, and how can he ever develop a masculine identity? That I had a good parent home, and my father was the right parent for me, and he provided me love and the things that are necessary to create a strong family. Mm-hmm. And so I think... even though I wasn't what I considered, I wasn't out about my family as an adolescent or in junior high, my father did often wear Gay Father's Forum t-shirts proudly on the beach, which was a sort of source of embarrassment. But adolescents are always embarrassed by their parents.
So, Samantha, stand by. We want to hear a lot more about it, but I want to get Nathaniel in here. He's sitting right here with me. Fine young man. Nathaniel, two moms, has been that way forever for you.
32 years they've been together.
32 years they've been together. You're 15 now.
Mm-hmm.
How's it been?
It has been overall a very positive experience. I think a little bit even more positive than a lot of other children I've met in this community. I've been grown up in Massachusetts, a liberal state. I've been going through the private school system my whole life, mm-hmm. and it's really been a positive experience. I mean, I have this great memory of, quote, coming out to all my friends in kindergarten. I got up, made the announcement. You know, everyone was like, why can't I have two moms? You know, that's really cool. I like moms. So it's...
Nathaniel says he's got two moms and there's jealousy around the classroom.
Exactly. I mean, it's been a positive experience, which isn't unusual, but I feel very lucky.
At 15, can you be fully candid? How do you deal with it? You know, when you meet new people or when you're making new friends, are you right up front about it? Are you a little guarded about it? How does it come up?
I try to be as open as I can, and I always have tried to be that way. Mm-hmm. I think that activism is very important. I think that it's important for me to use my skills to kind of spread awareness and respect of our community. I don't kind of say, hi, my name's Nathaniel, and I have two moms.
Mm-hmm.
But when people ask what my dad does, I say, I have two moms. One of them's a judge. One of them's a professor. I try not to hide it. And it has been hard in some settings, but I think that I've tried to be as open as I can, and overall that's been good.
And what's the percentage, what's the ratio of responses you get? Is it, you know, 75% everybody's cool with this, or half and half, or how does it tend to break down? You must have learned to read people's faces and eyes very well at that
yes,
moment.
Yes, I have. Although I have had a few problems, mainly at camp, I've had kids who can't get over the, you know, weirdness of my family. Generally, kids respect that my family is normal, and they, although a lot of them are interested in my two moms, they're interested in that relationship and that aspect of my life. They can separate me from my mom, so I'm just Nathaniel. I'm not the kid with two moms.
And how about adults? That's how kids respond. What about adults in your sphere when they meet you for the first time? Are they better at sort of taking the news on and running with it than kids or not?
Usually, I think they're better with it. Because kids, especially in the kind of middle school years, are often overtaken by the weirdness of it, whereas all the adults I've talked to about it have been respectful of it, at least. I don't know what they really think of that lifestyle, but I've found that adults have generally been receptive.
We're talking tonight with young Americans who've been raised by gay parents, looking at that experience from the perspective of kids who have lived it. Sol, Samantha and Nathaniel all sharing their stories with us, and there's a lot more that we want to learn. There's a lot we can learn from these three young people. You can join the conversation as well. What do you hear in the stories of kids raised by gay parents? Would it work in your school, in your neighborhood, in your town? Does it work already? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about being raised by gay parents in America, looking at that experience from the perspective of kids who have lived it. And there are more and more of them among us, in our towns, in our schools, in our children's circle of friends. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. What do you hear in the stories of kids raised by gay parents? If gay marriage becomes the law of the land, will the kids be all right? Does the marriage piece even matter? And if you've been raised by gay parents, has it worked for you? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight from around the country in Madison, Wisconsin, Seoul, 16 years old, two mothers. Baltimore, Maryland, Samantha, 24 years old now, getting a master's degree in health science at Johns Hopkins, raised after a bitter custody battle by her gay father. And with me in the studio, Nathaniel, 15 now, two mothers. Each of them with a story to tell. We're also joined right now from New York by Judith Stacy. She's a professor of sociology at New York University. She's author of In the Name of the Family, Rethinking Family Values in a Postmodern Age. Good evening and welcome, Judith Stacy.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. Judith, you've been listening to the stories that we're hearing tonight, and you've done a lot of research as a sociologist about this, the whole dynamic of gay parents, their children. Are you hearing familiar stories from our guests tonight?
Yes,
and what's important for people to know about this family structure?
I'm hearing both familiar stories and very individual stories, which I think, you know, every story is very particular and different. Sociologists deal in the general patterns, so these are certainly all patterns I've heard before, but it's very impressive to hear these young people talk so eloquently and articulately about their very particular stories.
You've looked at all kinds of families, mm-hmm. including families where the main parent or both parents are gay. Are there distinct differences that a sociologist would point to in the children that come out of these families from other kinds of American families? Are there patterns here or not?
There are some patterns. They're very hard to, you can't say that you could absolutely identify patterns because we don't have what sociologists call a base population to be able to make statistical generalizations because mm-hmm. you don't know how many gay or lesbian parents there are technically, and so you can't make that kind of a generalization. But there have been many, many studies over several decades now, and I think there are a few generalizations that are pretty safe. One is that the children who've been raised by self-identified lesbian and gay parents mm-hmm. Don't turn out on most of the measures that child development people are interested in to be very dramatically different from any other kid.
Mm-hmm. Measures such as?
Cognitive development, mental health, social integration, how successful kids are, how they get along with their peers.
So they fit into the norm on all those measures, pretty much.
Yeah, all of those things. They're mm-hmm. pretty similar. Mm-hmm. In some areas, in a few studies, they do a little bit better than other kids, which surprises some people. And I think that has to do, for example, there are a few studies where girls who've been raised by lesbian moms rate themselves more popular than other girls. So that would seem to fly in the face of some of the things you might imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some notion that, I think you heard it in some of these stories, that parents who are dealing with social stigma and are very aware of it often are doing a lot of work to prepare their kids to cope. And so these are kids who are often very articulate and self-aware and have been raised in environments where parents are much more communicative.
So, Seoul, in Madison, if I'm not wrong, that would seem to describe you pretty well. Have you felt that in addition to being a self-described beloved child, that in a way you're also a social project, that your parents have worked hard to arm you in such a way that you can go out in the world with your unique situation there and be effective, safe, all the rest?
Absolutely. Yeah, I feel very well prepared to go out in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I would say, you know, there's been a lot, I think there's no question that on average, and it depends entirely on which community, which environment, et cetera, a child grows up in, as you can see from these three very different stories, how they'll be treated by their peers and by the other members of that community. But I think basically kids can be pretty tough on other kids for a thousand reasons.
Mm-hmm. And are.
Here as the mother of a now successfully raised son. And so the question often is what things kids are going to pick up on. It's not at all clear from the studies that kids with gay or lesbian parents are teased or picked on necessarily more than other kids. But if they're picked on, this might be an issue that they'll be picked on about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's really hard to, as we say in social science, control for, do a study where you really know how much someone's being teased compared to another kid, you know, or something like that.
And Nathaniel, when you look at other friends who have a traditional father, mother, male, female parents, I'm just curious, you know, how do you feel about it? Do you feel, gosh, I wish I knew what that was like? What about the absence of a father? Do you think about it? Is it an issue in your life? Do you feel that it's something missing? Or take us into that. It's fascinating.
I have sometimes throughout my life wished that I had the influence of a father.
Mm-hmm.
I was born through something called artificial insemination,
mm-hmm.
and the process was randomized, which means that I'm never going to be able to find my biological father.
So one of your mothers bore you, but the sperm came from somebody, and you won't know who that is.
Exactly. That's the way that a lot of people do it.
Mm-hmm.
Some other families choose not a randomization so that when the child is 18 or 21, they can seek out the father.
This is your biological father, even though he's not your parent.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. I wish that I had a father. I think I see my friends' fathers, and jealousy might not be the right word, but it's an experience that I wish that I could connect to a little bit
mm-hmm.
more. My parents have done a great job of providing male role models
mm-hmm.
in my life,
mm-hmm.
surrounding me by great, wonderful, straight and gay men who
mm-hmm.
I can look up to. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's just really not the same as my friends'
right,
fathers.
Right.
Now, I do have two spectacular mothers, and they've done a great job
right,
raising me.
Right, right.
I think it's a father would be nice, but two mothers has been great.
And Sol, same question to you. Nathaniel looks at it as a young man, you as a young woman. How do you look at it? Is there something missing sometimes, or does it you know all add up in a way that you say fine?
Well, it feels really good to me. I think there's all different kinds of families,
mm-hmm.
And I think I feel really lucky because I have two parents who have been there for me, and as you said, are spectacular parents, you know, and have just, you know, have been involved in my life and have been involved in school and have just been, you know, involved in the community. And I think also one of the things that I've been really lucky about growing up in a gay family is I've also been given a whole community, you know, queer culture with its uniqueness and colorfulness and beauty.
Right.
But I've also, like you said, been given models of all different kinds of families and all different kinds of men, which has been, I think, has really enriched my life.
And so how do your parents talk to you about sexuality? I mean, you've got queer culture, which is much more than sexuality, but,
oh, yeah.
But you know, you're at the age where this is in the air. Do they give you guidance? Do they say, go this way, go that way? Is it an open field? is it just like, you know, any other family where the child just discovers their own sexuality and that's that?
I think it is. I feel lucky because I knew that no matter what my sexual orientation ended up being, my parents would absolutely love me and would support me in that. So I feel like it's been really open. And I feel like I've been able to just go where my heart leads me. And that's been, I think I've been really lucky to have that.
By the way, I do think that is one of the ways in which children with gay and lesbian parents are a little bit different from children with heterosexual parents on average, in that they really are given more permission to feel as though however they develop sexually will be all right. I mean, a lot of the horror stories that we have of kids being tossed out of families because of their gay desires.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after all, most people who grow up to be gay were raised with heterosexual parents.
Of course.
The majority of kids who have gay and lesbian parents, for mysterious reasons, I'd say, turn out to be heterosexual. But a larger minority of kids with gay and lesbian parents probably will turn out to be not just heterosexual. And I think that has at least as much to do with the sense that you just heard expressed of the support of parents no matter what. The parents don't have, you know, you're not going to be tossed out for having a desire that's considered to be, you know, socially stigmatized.
Well, there's the model of a kind of freedom of choice sitting right in front of that child.
Right. Exactly.
Samantha, let me turn to you.
As well as the costs. I mean, I think the kids are pretty savvy about, you know, some of the social issues attached to sexuality.
So they've seen firsthand sometimes the price that's paid for those choices.
The price and the advantages, all of the above.
Yep. Samantha, your thoughts on that front. I mean, you had a different experience from either Nathaniel or Sol. How did your gay father speak to the issue of sexuality with you?
Well, I don't think, I mean, I guess I'm not sure whether you mean whether he talked to me about his sexuality or just the issue of sexuality in general. In general, it was sort of always just very open, and he tells me the story of how he and his partner had introduced me to some friend of theirs or something, and I asked something about the fact that this guy had a male partner, and I was maybe 3 or 4, and my dad said, oh, well, you know, some men love men, some men love women, some women love women, and some women love men. And I was like, oh, okay. And then that was sort of the end of the discussion. And so I do think what everyone else has been saying is very true, that there's been this openness that, at least for me, growing up and developing my sexuality, I've always been very conscious of it and very sort of contemplative about it and wondering and sort of evaluating, like, am I really heterosexual? Is this really what I want? And just sort of this awareness of, A, the consequences of living a life where you suddenly realize at 45 that maybe you're not, you know, in the right lifestyle, but also just feeling whatever happens is okay. And it's understanding that you can have a successful and very happy life no matter what your sexual orientation is. And I do think one thing that I wanted to go back to is just very important is this issue for at least the kids that we're talking to, who came out of a family that's through artificial insemination or that this was a family that was created by choice. And in most heterosexual relationships, you know, there's not that guarantee that sometimes kids are born because it happens and
it can be an accident.
Along. Right. And not in a negative way, but just that there have been so many obstacles to creating a family if you were lesbian and gay in the last 30 years, whatever. And so the families it seems to me, are much stronger in many respects. Not that they're not without their problems that every other type of family might have. But
someone or some couple worked really hard, especially hard to make this happen.
Right. And it was a very conscious choice. And I think that's important that there is this recognition of the responsibility of being a parent and what that means. And, you know, really, and in my case, my father had to fight very hard to have me really in his life. And that, again, demonstrates that, you know, there was this desire for me to be there and that the assumption that just because my mother was my biological and female mother doesn't mean that she was inherently the better parent for me. So I think that it's that issue of choice.
We're talking tonight about being raised by gay parents in America. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and a lot of people want to join our conversation. I want to turn to them. Lori's calling from Beverly, Massachusetts. Hi, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I actually was calling. My partner and I are about to give birth to our first child in January. And I just wanted to ask the kids, you know, I know it's a slightly easier time now, but what did your parents do right to help you become the people that you are right now?
So your partner and you, a lesbian couple.
Yes.
And you've got a baby on the way.
On the way.
Coming in January.
Yes.
And every parent-to-be wants good advice.
Yes.
Nathaniel, you get to be the sage, wise one here tonight. Lori, I think you're expecting a son.
Yes.
So maybe your advice is the most relevant of all. What do you have to say to Lori?
Let's see. I think that make your son known from an early age that he comes from a great family. And like other people were saying, like kids like us know that we're loved because people tried very hard to make our family.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that I wished I had a father, I think it's also clear I have two parents, and I have two loving parents, and that's a lot more than some kids out there have. And I know how lucky I am to have that. Make sure your son knows that families come in all different kinds. His family is normal, and don't worry too much about the male role model issue. I know that a lot of lesbian couples, especially with male children, really think that, you know,
Obsessed about that.
How is my son going to have a masculine identity? Mm-hmm. I think that men, or boys and men, find role models and will discover their own gender identity, their own sexuality, and it's generally a pretty easy path.
And what about the issue that must be on Lori's mind to some extent, the protectiveness factor? You know, does she want to be extra protective? Not? Do you need extra protection?
I don't think extra protection is exactly. I mean, protection would have to be the wrong word. Make sure you're always there for your son. If he wants to come out to his friends, if he needs to not come out to his friends, make sure you support him in that. And because sometimes it's tough for lesbians who are used to being out their whole lives when their children then don't want to come out.
Yeah, because they've lived the out life, and now the children are maybe sometimes like all children. They'd be shy about something.
Exactly, and I've actually gone the other way with my parents, too. I'm so used to just getting it out there, and if people don't like that, then I don't want them to be my friends.
Did you have to mention that right away?
Exactly. So just keep in mind, you need to let your son make decisions about your family and always support them in that.
Lori, are you hearing what you need there?
Yeah, what about the tools? Someone had mentioned tools that they were taught. I don't know if it was a Samantha. Tools that they were taught to help them deal with situations. I think one of the tools was role playing. I think, you know, we're out. We're going to be more out because of our son. Mm-hmm. Maybe more out than we even want to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, in giving him the love and the freedom and the backing, but sometimes we're not there to do that. He's got to be out in the world at some point dealing with this issue when we're not there.
Right. Sol, Samantha, may I turn to you? One of you mentioned role playing.
Oh, Sol.
Yeah, I know from a young age, especially having two moms and having one biological mom and one non-biological mom, a question that always came up a lot was, you know, who's the real mom? And I remember specifically my parents sitting me down on the couch when I was a little kid and telling me that kids would ask this question and, you know, what did I feel comfortable answering and things like that. So they'd run through some of the different prejudices people have and different questions people ask. But I think what Nathaniel was saying, too, is that just being really open and knowing that it's your son's choice, but also, you know, telling him that he has a strong community, too, and he has a place where he can talk with other kids in gay families. I think that's one of the really important things I know in my life.
And what about that issue of the biological mom? Because it would only be one of your moms. Was that a big deal in your mind, in your family's life, Sol?
Oh, absolutely not, because both my parents they're completely different people, and they both offer me something really special and unique. And one of them happens to be my non-biological mom, and one of them happens to be, you know, my biological mom, but it's just wonderful. I get so much from each of them.
We've got it. Lori, I hope that's helpful. Thanks for your call. We're talking tonight about being raised by gay parents in America, looking at that experience from the perspective of kids who have lived it. We are lucky to be joined tonight by Sol, by Nathaniel, by Samantha, and by Judith Stacy in New York. You can join us, too. Gay parents, are your kids accepted? Do they face special hurdles or not? And straight parents, do you see this new world with an open mind or with wariness? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from
tonight about being raised by gay parents in America, looking at that experience from the perspective of kids who have lived it. The issue of gay marriage is very likely to be a significant campaign issue in the presidential campaign that is gearing up now, that will get hot next year. You can imagine how that may play out. This may be center stage. We're getting a firsthand view from people not just in a gay world, but raised by gay parents. My guests tonight, Sol and Madison, 16 years old, two mothers. With me in the studio, Nathaniel, 15, two mothers, joining us from Baltimore, Maryland. Samantha, her father came out as gay, won custody. He raised her. And joining us also from New York, Judith Stacy, professor of sociology at NYU and author of Brave New Families, Stories of Domestic Upheaval in Late 20th Century America. You can join us as well. Is America now big enough for any family structure that's loving, that's nurturing, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Angela's calling from Morton, Pennsylvania. Hi, Angela. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just calling to say that the last year and a half
since my daughters and I have been living with my partner have been incredible. I have an 8-year-old and a 9-year-old, and I single-parented them all their life. And since I've been with my partner, they have just become so much more well-adjusted. They're becoming such wonderful young ladies. They just...
So you're in a gay partnership, and having two parents, in this case two moms, is working better for your kids than just having a single mom.
Right. And I think it's just having the extra parent there, but I think there's also a lot of benefits. I think that they think it's really special. We go to a gay-oriented church, and they just absolutely love it. And we're also raising my partner's niece now, who's 7. So we have 3 girls, 7, 8, and 9. And they're actually all right here. Say hi.
Hi.
Hi, girls. We hear you loud and clear. Angela, how's it been in your community? Has there been open arms, receptive community, accepting community, or not?
Most of it has been accepting. There's been maybe one or two who actually... their friendship just kind of faded away when they discovered the type of family that we have. And, you know, we just kind of, you know, brushed it off and didn't let it affect us too much. But for the most part, everybody's been accepting. My daughters have sleepovers. I mean, that hasn't been a problem. I think there's one little girl that doesn't do sleepovers. But basically, it's just, you know, a normal family, and
it's working for you. And we hear those healthy young voices. Angela, our time's running low, but we thank you for your call.
One thing I would say is that there actually is research to suggest that kids often do better with lesbian stepmoms than they do with heterosexual stepdads. And
do better in terms of just general development,
getting along better, and feeling more attached to them.
Fascinating, Samantha. I want to put this political question to you, and our time is very short. But you know. Mm-hmm. George Bush says very recently, "I believe a marriage is between a man and a woman." And many Americans agree with that, or at least feel, gosh, isn't that the way it ought to be? How do you look at this big political question the country is now staring at?
Well, I think the problem is that there's sort of this conflation of religion and politics that's going on. And the issue of marriage and gay marriage is more about civil rights than it is about legislating religious and moral actions. And so it seems to me the problem is that people are being denied access to rights, even if they commit to a relationship, as I think Nathaniel said, his parents have been together for 30-some-odd years. And if something were to happen to one of them, there are legal ways to get around it. But essentially, they're denied Social Security rights and privileges if one of them dies. And there are things that are just blatantly they're not allowed access to because their partnership.
Because they can't be legally, formally married.
Recognized, right. And it's interesting because a big trend in my sort of friend group and peers is for heterosexual couples to choose not to get married. And I actually just attended a commitment ceremony of a man and a woman who have chosen not to get married, who are in their late 20s. And actually the woman's father is gay, but they did it for political reasons, that they feel that until this marriage is a right that's available to every member of this country, that they do not want to participate in a prejudiced institution, basically. So I do think that the Bush's perspective and all the sort of talking heads' perspective that are against marriage are really confusing the issue and bringing in moral and religious overtones that are inappropriate. And if the religious institutions choose not to accept it, that's something separate. But in terms of having access to civil liberties and benefits that we allow certain people and not others in this country, it just doesn't seem acceptable to me.
But of course, the realm of politics, everything comes into play.
Right,
and next year, it's going to be very likely a big issue. This conversation, we'll remember when that comes up for the intimate perspective that you all have brought to us and that we're very grateful for tonight. Samantha in Baltimore, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
A master's student at Johns Hopkins University in health science. And Sol in Madison, thanks so much for being with us there.
Well, thank you.
And Nathaniel, right here with me, 15 years old. Thanks a lot for coming in tonight.
Thanks
great
for
to have
providing
you.
The opportunity.
Judith Stacey at NYU, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
They're kicking down bathroom doors at bachelor pads across America, tearing through closets, pulling open refrigerators, and throwing out week-old leftovers. The funny, full-on fashion frenzy of cable TV's gay Fab Five have made the makeover show Queer Eye for the Straight Guy one of the season's biggest television hits.
This look is very Christian LaCroix, and you're all ready for the Oscars. You know, a simple terry wrap. It's
maybe very, a little necklace, little
very Versace.
There.
TV's gay gurus of high style, along with Will and Grace and this fall's new It's All Relative, are following an entertainment tradition of embracing homosexuality, blazed by Hollywood. While television has put gay characters into American living rooms only recently, it's movies that brought homosexuals and their stories into the American mainstream. Here to walk us through Hollywood's take on gay America is On Point movie maven Garen Daly. Hi, Garen.
Hey, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. So, Garen, it wasn't so many years ago that homophobia was more or less the law of the land in the United States. Not everywhere, but very widely. Hollywood, you're saying, put the wedge in that.
Yeah. Hollywood, from like the 30s to the 60s, was basically, you know, would not even touch the gay subculture. They wouldn't even say the word gay or lesbian. It was all part of the Hayes Commission. It started breaking up with Boys in the Band in the 60s and started accelerating in the 80s and 90s, where gay characters were being introduced. Now, a lot of these characters were sanitized, and they didn't really present the entire gay subculture or gay culture. However, when Jonathan Demme made Philadelphia with Tom Hanks and Denzel Washington, one playing a man with AIDS, the other being his lawyer, he really kind of brought forth the entire question right to the fore, so much so that he was kind of instructing us as a heterosexual society on what we should be looking at and how we should be responding.
AIDS made it possible to talk about. There was an epidemic, but right behind that came the whole fact of homosexuality in Philadelphia, saying, here it is.
Here it is, and here is homosexuality versus heterosexuality, and Denzel Washington had to deal with it.
All right, well, hey, I admit it, okay? I'm prejudiced. I don't like homosexuals. There, you got me.
All right.
Hey, I'm being totally honest with you, okay?
Oh, yeah, you are.
All right. I got a question for you. Would you accept a client if you were constantly thinking, I don't want this person to touch me, I don't want them to even breathe on me?
Not if I was you, honey.
That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Denzel Washington laying it down like a lot of America felt it at the time in Philadelphia in 1993. But Hollywood, through laying it out that way, Garen, opening up a path for a conversation about homosexuality to walk in.
Yeah, it was a path. It was a gradual path. We weren't really willing to accept a lot of what the gay culture was meaning to America. I mean, again, when you take a look at the films we're going to be talking about, very few of them actually dealt with gay sexuality. You know, it was always a little standoffish. The question of that...
Denzel's jumping in up to his elbows here talking about it, but you're right. The fact stayed offstage.
That's right. The facts, the action stayed offstage. You know, the cinema masculinity was still the status quo. I mean, we can even go back to like 1983 and Victor Victoria, where Blake Edwards took an old 1933 German film which questioned the idea of feminine, the idea of masculine. And in this film, what he did very smartly was he took two male icons, James Garner, who was the lead of Rockford Files and Maverick, and Alex Karras, who was an NFL player, two very macho guys, and thrust them in a situation where they had to question their own masculinity and whether or not they were gay or whether they weren't gay.
What's going on there, Gary?
Alex Karras has actually broke into the room where James Garner is in bed with Julie Andrews. He thinks Julie Andrews is a guy, so therefore he thinks that his boss, James Garner, is gay because he's in bed with a guy.
So in 1983, you could do it with a kind of a rumpus and a mix-up and a little on-screen chaos.
A little gender bending going on, a little gender confusion.
Oh, my God. I'm really sorry. Squash? Squash? Hey, Squash, look, I know what you're thinking.
No, you don't. In one fell swoop, you've changed my whole life.
It wasn't that kind of swoop.
Listen, boss, if a guy like you's got the guts to admit he's gay, so can I. You've made me so happy.
You've got As Good As It Gets on your list here. 1997, Jack Nicholson, Helen Hunt, Greg Kinnear. Why?
We're beginning to accept the gay sidekick or the gay person who was a featured player, not the lead player. The writers started introducing issues that were important to the gay community. And As Good As It Gets, we deal with gay bashing, and Greg Kinnear gets really beat up. And we're going to listen to a scene where he is in the hospital, and Cuba Gooding and Yardley Smith, two of his best friends, are coming to see him after he's been savagely beaten up by some gay bashers.
Okay, I talked to the doctor and okay, it's not that bad. I talked to the doctors and they say you're gonna be your old self in a couple of weeks. I mean, the scars here might take a little.
Jackie.
Yes.
Can you hand me a mirror, please?
No. I have a smaller one.
So how are things anyway? Oh my.
And there's another kind of reality dealing with the pain of someone who's just been beat to a pulp by homophobes.
And the thing to remember, too, is that when they introduce us into the films, they're putting a human face on it. They're making us, you know, respond emotionally to this violence. And this is something that had been kept in the background. We weren't really made aware of how much violence and gay bashing was going on. But when Greg Kinnear gets beat up like that and gets damaged like that, we sympathize with it. So we're sympathizing with someone who's been damaged.
So there's the difficult side of worlds colliding around homosexuality. But Hollywood has also put it in a very glossy kind of light and wonderful glow many times. My Best Friend's Wedding.
My Best Friend's Wedding. And this is almost like a redefinition of what a good friend is and what a potential lover might be. In this film, Rupert Everett plays Julia Roberts' best friend, who gives her the best advice that he can give. And at the end of the film, she's had to say goodbye to a former lover. She's now lonely. And to wrap up this film in a good romantic comedy, we have a gay man who is the guy that wraps things up and makes it better.
And then suddenly, the crowd's part. And there he is. Sleek, stylish, radiant with charisma. Bizarrely, he's on the telephone. But then, so are you. And he comes towards you. The moves of a jungle cat. And although you quite correctly sense that he is gay, like most devastatingly handsome single men of his age are, you think, what the hell? Life goes on. Maybe there won't be marriage. Maybe there won't be sex. But by God, there'll be dancing.
My Best Friend's Wedding, 1997. Garen, each of these and others, groundbreakers in their own way, put forward by Hollywood, now television running right on down the field with the theme of gay this, gay that, gay life. Is there still ground for Hollywood to break around this subject, or has it now just become so mainstream that it's TV's property?
Well, I think there is a lot of ground to be covered. I think what we need to look at is, you know, the full breadth of what the gay culture is. I also think that Hollywood will, as we get more accepting of different lifestyles and become more diversified, we will look at many different angles on this.
Garen Daly, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is Artistic Director of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point movie maven. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from